The Guardian.
On to Den Linden. Hello and welcome to Music Weekly from Guardian.co.uk. I'm Paul McInnes, and on this week's show...
We won't be waking soon. I could be cold by noon.
You know, tonight I've got no money in my life. I swear next time I'll buy.
That there is the sound of the Holy Ghost Revival rocking out in this very pod, and we'll be talking to the band about their bid to make glam rock acceptable a little later on. We'll also be chewing up and spitting delicately into a handkerchief new music from Das Pop, Santo Gold and The Verve. We'll round up the best of you, but first we're going to get our grunge on with Mudhoney. That was Touch Me, I'm Sick by Mudhoney in their 1988 Pomp. They were one of the linchpins of the Seattle scene that took over the world. Therefore, who better to give us the lowdown on grunge than our very own disaffected, plaid-wearing anarchist, Ms. Rosie Swash.
Hello.
Hello. I see you've got your fist raised there in some kind of anarchic salute.
That's right.
Yeah, man. What's going on the anarchic underground right now?
Anything I can't cool? possibly tell you. Don't be ridiculous.
So it's 20 years since the launch of Sub Pop, which is kind of like Seattle's iconic label and the one that arguably helped to give birth to grunge. So it seems an appropriate point to be looking back. What was it, in retrospect, that grunge actually gave us?
Well, grunge was, I guess, it became the sort of defining alternative rock music of the time, because partly because it combined elements of metal and hardcore, which were two well-established subcultures. It also existed locally, so it was like really truly underground. But then it namely really blew up with Nirvana. And there were other bands like Pearl Jam who are grunge and Soundgarden, but it was really Nirvana that were the big hitters.
And the thing was, they stripped away the kind of pomposity of metal that had preceded it. How did Mudhoney fit into this whole shebang then?
Well, Mudhoney was sort of, they were precursors to it in a way that, first of all, a lot of the band, or Mark Arm, the founder, was in Green River, who were the first ever grunge band. When they became Mudhoney, they signed to Sub Pop immediately. They were the Sub Pop band. Sub Pop sort of started off because and by signing them, and they stayed with the label on and off up until the current day. Mudhoney never quite made it, but there's always this: if it wasn't for them, there would be no Nirvana.
So you met them this week?
I did indeed. They've got a new album out at the moment. As I said, they're still going and they're playing some shows over here. But they're also playing a lot of shows to do with Sub Pop 20th anniversary. So I wanted to ask Mark and Steve from the band what it was like having a new album out, but also having to look back. Was it a bit weird?
We knew it was going to happen. We knew we'd be talking about 20 years ago.
A year of reflection.
Yeah. It didn't bother you? Don't worry that it's going to overshadow the Lucky Ones?
Oh, it does. It does. But it doesn't worry us.
Yeah, it doesn't worry anyway. You know.
So now we're going to talk quite exclusively about Sub Pop for a little while, now that I've set you up with that. I mean, how different is it? Because you knew the founders of the label before it even existed, and it must have been incredibly small time when you started.
It was incredibly small time. We would, like, you know, stuff singles at Bruce Pavitt's apartment.
Here comes sickness, walking down my street.
The bands were totally hands-on and involved. Now the kids these days on the label, they don't come in and they don't do crap.
Is it weird for you to see it, you know, as a fully functioning company?
Well, you know, it was a fully functioning company pretty quick. Yeah, they got their office in 88.
I don't know if they were actually fully functioning. They had major cash flow problems and, you know, there was a lot of bluster behind their talk and panic deep inside, I think.
Yeah, it was a low period for our relationship with Sub Pop because they owed us money. They were having a hard time at that point. They were, you know, that was before Nirvana hit with Nevermind, was when we decided to leave. We'd put out our last record with them, the Every Good Boy Deserves Fudge.
Which was ready like half a year before it came out.
Yeah, they delayed it a little bit because they were having problems.
They didn't have, you know, they couldn't press it.
And it was frustrating for us because we were trying to organize tours and we had to wait for the record to come out. And so we just decided to leave them because we didn't want to hate each other.
And so what was it like going to a major? Because, you know, it's our majors are evil.
Well, we were pretty organized and self-reliant at that point. You know, we were doing fine. We were touring a lot. You know, we didn't need much from a record label in our minds. Like, we didn't have ambitions to take it to, like, the next kind of step or anything like that, I don't think.
We just wanted someone to put out our records on a consistent basis.
Yeah. They left us alone, really, because after Nevermind hit, the majors really didn't have a clue. I'm sure they didn't like our band, but they were like, well, they're part of that thing. You know, no, maybe this one will hit, too. You never know.
I was always very leery of major labels, you know, and what had happened to, like, some of the 80s bands, like the Replacements and Husker Du, when they signed to major labels, their records kind of sounded a lot slicker and cleaner and, you know, it just seemed like, oh, man, these labels just pick up these good bands and just kind of destroy them. Both those bands were signed to Warner's or subsidiaries of Warner's, which we eventually signed to.
Yeah.
And I remember asking Lenny Warnicker, who was the president of the label Point Blank, you know, when we met with them, like, what about these Husker
What about the Replacements? And what happened?
What happened? He's like, I don't know. I mean, they just took advantage of their budget. So they get a bigger budget and they think that's they need to use it all and that'll help sell records. Maybe it did. At the time, Sub Pop was distributed by Caroline Records, and we thought we would just cut out the middleman and go straight to Caroline Records, who at that time had released the Smashing Pumpkins' first record. So we met with this guy, Keith Wood, who ran that label, and he told us no one could do any side projects.
They're really uncomfortable with side projects.
And Steve and I had just done a Monkey Wrench record.
And I was in another band playing bass.
And then they said we would have to tour for 9 months out of the year because that's what happened to the Smashing Pumpkins.
Only way you break a band.
And then we would have to sweeten up our guitar sounds. And it's like, well, this is exactly why we didn't want it. That's exactly why we wouldn't. We were wary of being on a major label.
And we're like, now we can talk to the
major. Now we can talk to major labels.
His points were fine. It's just like not what we wanted.
And did you want to sell a lot more records?
No, that's the thing. Like, we didn't really care.
So for your experience of actually being on a major, it wasn't the sort of interfering aspect?
Not at all. It was so hands-off, especially when we went in to record the first record.
They really didn't want to mess with us at all. Nothing changed. It changed by the end of our time with Warner's. The entire staff and everybody, like, changed, and clearly we weren't selling them any records. And by the last record, it was irritating being on Warner Brothers.
When we signed to Warner's, the label was known as the artist-friendly major label. And it had this regime that had been there since the 70s. Somewhere in there, it went from Warner's to Time Warner's. Then it became AOL Time Warner's, you know. And if you know things are screwed up when, like, this internet thing is suddenly taking over these two established companies. So, yeah. And then we got kicked off the label.
I was going to say, so why did you go back to Sub Pop? Because there was a period of, like, 5 or 6 years before you had a new album.
Well, first, our bass player, Matt, retired. He didn't want to play music anymore. So we just kind of said, well, let's not do anything hasty.
And at the same time, we worked on March to Fuzz.
Yeah, and we did the double CD best of thing, which made it even seem more like we'd broken up because we had a best of career retrospective. and our bass player quit, and we were dropped from our label. I don't know why people thought we broke up.
And Steve and I were in another band.
Yeah, yeah. Why did people think we were broken up? I don't know. I'll drink the wine, squeeze from your vines till I'm much too drunk.
Did you think about breaking up?
We weren't really that concerned with it. You know, I was like, well, we'll see what happens, you know. But we started, like, practicing again and thinking about maybe just trying to record a record, you know, just the three of us. I was like, well, you know, we can probably work something out. It might be kind of a good way to stir things up and change things a little bit, you know.
Do you think that if you'd come of age as a band at a different time, say now, when the internet and music blogs are sort of so integral in how a band is broken, things might have been totally different for you because you existed at a time when it was fanzines were the sort of blog of their day.
Sure, it would be different. I mean, the rock and roll that we were into was just so underground and it was just for losers, really. I mean, really, like, it's not like, you know, the high school counselor said, okay, great. You want to be in a rock band? Good, good. Have you thought about, you know, how to best address this career goal? Like, they're just like, okay, you're an idiot.
Yeah. Now you go to a career counselor and you say, I want to be in the band. And they're like, right, great. Okay. Now you go to music camp.
Right, yeah, yeah. Instrument. Sure. But I'm not so sure I would have been attracted to rock had it been as readily accessible to me. I think I would have veered off course some other way, you know, in the modern world.
Okay, so final question. Is it still fun for you guys?
We wouldn't be doing it otherwise.
Sure.
We've got nothing to gain.
So that was Mark Arm and Steve Turner from Mudhoney, and their album The Lucky Ones is out now.
Taro, now let's review some music. It's the part of the pod we call the Singles Club, and we are proud to announce what by some standards might actually be called an innovation. Yes, for the first time, we are joined in the pod not by a hack, but by a listener, Martin Cooling, who I believe is on the line live and direct from Lincoln. Hello, Martin.
That I am.
How are you doing?
I'm all right, yeah.
Good to hear it. Now, you're a regular commenter on the blog. Not there's been all that many of them the last few weeks. I think there might have been some kind of extinction event occurring. Tell us for now, what do you do in your non-virtual life?
I work as a DJ and an event manager for a large club promotion firm.
What kind of stuff do you play as a DJ?
It's just like it's mashup stuff, so a bit of everything really. It's mainly student nights, if I'm going to be perfectly honest with you.
There's nothing. There's no shame in that game.
It's not cheesy stuff. It's a bit of everything really.
Can you give us a tune that we haven't heard of but should have?
Probably not. Probably not. You're pretty clued up down there, and anything I can probably name, you'll probably go, oh, 6 months ago I heard that.
Yeah, we'll pretend that anyway. But it's good to have you on board, Martin. We'll cut the end of the chittle chattel and we'll have some music. This is The Verve, and this is Love Is Noise. I was blind, couldn't see what was here in me. I was blind, insecure. Love is noise, love is pain, love is these blues I'm singing again. Love is noise, love is pain, love is these blues I'm singing again. That's Love is Noise by The Verve. And The Verve, well, they're quite famous, really. Probably the third biggest Britpop band after Oasis and Blur. They gave us 90s hits like Lucky Man, The Drugs Don't Work, and Bittersweet Symphony. They were so influential, in fact, that Limp Bizkit covered Bittersweet Symphony for their own Greatest Hits album. There's no higher praise than that. The band first formed in 1989 after meeting at Winstanley Sixth Form College in Wigan. That, fact fans, is also where The Guardian's Laura Barton went to school. Although whether Laura Barton ever ended up sitting on some old chewing gum left by Richard remains unclear. Rosie Swash.
Yes.
I'm sure you'd like to sit on Richard's chewing gum. What? What do you reckon of this, their comeback single?
I think it's absolutely fantastic.
Really?
I love it.
Yeah, really?
Yeah.
There's almost a consensus opinion forming on that, isn't it? There are lots of people who really like this song. What is it that's that good about this?
Well, I think there's various people talking about it being a return to form and like something you would have heard on a Northern Soul. But I was never a huge Verve fan, but I have quite liked them. And I think what this sort of distills what's really great about them when they're at their best is quintessentially very English with the William Blake lyrics. And it's hugely sentimental, but also quite masculine. And it's just got that fantastic beat, and it's quite uplifting. And that's what, when they're at their best, they did brilliantly.
Because for me, it just sounds very 90s. For exactly the same reasons as you cite there, the Blake stuff reminds me of, like, Vindaloo or something. And even the sampling and the sequencing sounds very clean and clear in a euphoric 90s way, none of this glitchy, nasty stuff that you get in the noughties. Martin, what does this take you back? Would this get a big cheer on a student dance floor?
No, I hate it. I personally hate it. It probably would get a cheer because people like that kind of nostalgia. And they like listening to things like The Twang and trying to think, ooh, yeah, I remember The Charlatans and things like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, people do, but I hate it personally. It's awful.
What is it that doesn't work for you?
It's because it relies so heavily on the nostalgia, it lacks any invention at all.
my mind would be closer to yours on this. The Verve have had a few comebacks. They've split up twice. They've reformed twice. This is their fourth album, but it has been highly anticipated in the way that the album previous hasn't been. When they failed in the past, my understanding was that it was stuck in a rut. Is it just a case of timing that you give a bit of a break and people are interested in this again?
Maybe. I think, for me, the way I've always looked at the Verve is that there were plenty of people that loved them, and then Urban Hymns took them to that next level. And then with the breakup, I think part of it is people's reaction to the kind of person Richard Ashcroft is and his solo career afterwards, which I actually quite liked some of it, but he seemed to really repulse quite a lot of people in a way. They didn't take to it at all. They were caught up in that kind of laddie Britpop thing, even though they preceded it, and that's not entirely their fault. And I think this time round, like what Martin was saying about it, relies on the nostalgia, but it relies on their own nostalgia for their own stuff, mm-hmm. Which is kind of okay. And it's also, I mean, it's got that loop in it, that sort of dance loop, which I kind of feel like, oh, God, you know, indie bands trying to be a bit dance, that's like the worst thing ever. But for me, that just sounds like some producers come along and thought this little tiny sample here would finesse this track. And it kind of makes it. I don't know whose call it was, or, you know, whether it was something that came along afterwards. But I think that there's something about that in the song that really makes it.
Yeah, I think I might agree with you. I wonder also whether it's people might feel that after they crashed and failed a little bit that they're willing to give them another chance. Anyway, Love Is Noise by The Verve is out on August the 4th. Second track on Singles Club is Underground by Das Pop. And it may be hard to understand. That's Das Pop with Underground. Das Pop are Belgian. Though they've got a drummer from New Zealand, they've been around since 1994. But this is from their first major label album called Fuckland. Yes, Fuckland. It's produced by Soulwax, but while it was supposed to be released last year, it now ain't coming out until the autumn. Martin, does that give you slightly nervous presentiments about the quality of this debut album?
Yeah, I've heard a lot of Das Pop stuff. Well, since I realised we're going to be reviewing this today.
You're not supposed to be that frank. You're supposed to keep that one. You're hidden.
I'm ruining the illusion of it.
Yeah, that's right.
I look back on a lot of their stuff, and a lot of their older stuff is really good, really catchy, really well written, and I like it. And then there's a lot of hype around this track, and I just don't see the appeal.
No, what really galls me is the scansion. The guy, I mean, he's not singing in his first language, Giles Corran's made this fashionable, you know, quote Giles Corran, you know, does he even, this is pre-GCSE meter we're talking about here. The guy doesn't know when to kind of put stress on the word, and things trail away when they should be going up on all this sort of stuff. It just sounds bizarre. I presume he's actually doing it intentionally, but it just sounds very odd. And I have to say, the chorus, which I like, it is Andrew Gold's Lucky Boy. Oh, what a lucky boy, from like 1974 or whatever. Rosie.
I hadn't picked up on what you were saying about the stresses, and I think that's very much at the heart of it. There's something about it, you're just listening to Das Pop and your mind totally wanders. There's too much reliant on their personality, and the personality that they bring to it is not unique enough. I look at them as falling somewhere in between Franz Ferdinand and Hot Chip and what they're trying to achieve and the sound they're trying to make. And they don't have the qualities of either of those bands which have made them popular. And I never really feel like they're being themselves or they're trying too hard to present something in their music which is not that appealing.
Yeah, there's also this archness to it, lyrics like Time Spent with a Half-Wit, The Things You Learn in Germany. It's all, it is quite arty and in a Franz Ferdinand-y way. But it's a difficult trick to pull off. Martin, how about this thing between falling between the stools of dance and rock?
I don't think it does, to be fair. I think that falls on the rock side. It just sounds like jangly indie from Britain, with maybe some of the jangle removed a little bit. It's a little more clean, it's a little more produced, and just very typical of music that is floating around at the moment. It does have a slight dance feel to it. I suppose that's why it's been championed by bands like Justice and Soulwax and things like that. And that they've got interest in it. It's been included in a lot of their mixtapes. But I don't know. It's just the track doesn't do anything for me.
It's very, very. He's got a sharp edge, this young man. I would also encourage listeners not to listen to the Busy P remix of this track because that is tragic. It is equally dire. Equally dire. All right. Well, that is Underground by Das Pop, and it comes out on August the 4th. Also, final track on Singles Club is Lights Out by Santo Gold. That's Santo Gold's Lights Out. Santo Gold, you've heard on this show before. She's really Santi White. She's a Brooklyn-based artiste, and her keyword is eclectic. She's also working with everyone from David Byrne to Jay-Z. So, like, she's really popular, yeah? Although her album didn't do very well. Rosie, yes. This song.
I like this song.
This song actually, for all the eclecticism, this might actually be quite to the molten core of what Santo Gold is about, you know?
Agreed. And I'd like to just tell the listeners now that the Santo Gold album is probably the only album that you and I have listened to together.
It is. It was very touching, driving down to ATP.
Exactly. And we decided then, we were like, no, not into it. This is all hype, etc. She's trying to be like MIA. I've had that album on my iPod to try and give it a proper listen ever since. And what I find with songs like this that I think is just, that's a great hook, her voice sounds so captivating that you just want to hear more of it, is that she just doesn't take enough of a risk in any of the songs she does. It's got that nice ska bass line, and she's got a history of that kind of music. It's a bit Blondie-esque. It's just a bit like she got everybody's attention with Shove It and stuff like that, and then she just served up all this much more palatable stuff that she didn't want to take any huge risks and become someone like MIA who doesn't really sell any records.
Mm-hmm. It sounds to me that this Michael Hammack described this as being part of the post-punk, digging around. Does the post-post-post stuff do anything for you, Martin? Do you think there's a bit too much of it right now?
Yeah, essentially. It dilutes things, really. People try and reach too far sometimes, I think. But at the same time, I'm completely sucked in with Santo Gold. From first time I heard Creator, I've not disliked anything she's put out, apart from the song she wrote for Ashley Simpson, which is dire. But yeah, apart from that, and this is similarly the same, it's quite lo-fi, it's got some kind of floaty vocals to it, and it's just a nice, casual summer song. And I think it's just been released at about the right time.
I wonder whether her personality ever comes through in her tunes. They're floaty, they're also a bit icy, and they're muted through the production. And I wonder, when somebody is a solo artist, whether there needs to be more of themselves in the actual music. Martin, am I talking Rob?
No, I mean, well, I think Lily Allen, for me, I think what made a lot of her music really catchy and really good is you do get a lot of her personality coming through in it.
Yeah.
And I think that's just one thing that made her so popular, because you could connect to her. And same with Amy Winehouse.
Exactly.
I think a lot of the times, them as two standout female solo artists, a lot of their personality shows through in their music. And yeah, I mean, sometimes her stuff can be a little bleak of personality, but I don't know, it does peak through at certain points.
Yeah, another interesting contrast with MIA there, who is very much her personality through all her music. But that is Santo Gold, that is Lights Out, and that is out on August the 11th. A couple of posts from the blog regarding last week's singles. EJD, the master of all knowledge, schooled me a little on my observation that the Cool Kids, despite being awfully retro, are the first act to soup up classic 80s hip-hop beats. About the Cool Kids, he writes, you could say the Neptunes refurbished that sparse old cool sound on songs like Grinding by Clips. I feel like I should like the Cool Kids, but I struggle to listen to a whole song. M-Han is whipped. But he's absolutely right about the safety dance. It's brilliant. Newcomer Shane 07 also confessed to a moment of enlightenment regarding Late of the Pier. I hate to admit, but Late of the Pier single was excellent. I don't usually enjoy this type of synth-dop music. However, I will probably buy the album if their other material is up to a similar standard. It cheered me right up in work. Martin, you which side of the Late of the Pier fence do you fall on?
I enjoyed The Bears Are Coming, but I don't enjoy this track as much.
But I imagine they go down well at a disco.
They
disco
do.
Night.
Bears are coming absolutely slay to dance floor. People love it.
Yeah, indeed. Okay, well, this week we want your reviews of The Verve, Das Pop and Santo Gold. You can post on the blog at blogs.guardian.co.uk/music or messages on Facebook or even Twitterify us, where our handle is Guardian Music. And with that, here's the montage.
Nora and the Whale, 5 years' time.
Lil Wayne featuring T-Pain, Got Money. Magistrates, Make This Work. The Wave Pictures, Just Like a Drummer EP.
Sleep just like a drummer. Wake up with the thunder.
Just like a drummer.
Of your typewriter.
Okay, that there was the montage, and that there was Martin Cooling's debut appearance on Music Weekly. Hope you enjoyed it, Martin. You did yourself remarkably proud, I have to say.
Yeah, I enjoyed it. It was good times.
Good. So what's up this afternoon? We found out earlier on, we were doing a bit of sound checking. You've had a reggae chicken sub today.
I've actually got to finish my reggae. you interrupted me halfway through. I got halfway through the sandwich.
Was that a 4-inch or an 8-inch?
I went for the full 8-inch.
Yeah, indeed. So he's got 3.5 sitting there on a plate. Thanks very much for coming in and talking with us today, Martin.
It's okay.
Right, that's it for Singles Club, but you can read some texticular reviews each week on the site. Sometimes they're done by Rosie, sometimes they're done by Tim Jones, and sometimes, like this week, they're done by Batman. Yep. To find out more, you're going to have to go to Guardian/music. Next on Weekly, though, it's like Twisted Sister never happened. It's not too hard to be cold. It's too large to be snow. And you're feeling very hard and very That's Embrace the Hate by Holy Ghost Revival, our second Seattle act of the show, no less. They may come from the heart of grunge, but this band, recently relocated to London, are as far removed from plaid and earnest behaviour as can be. Now, it's debatable whether a band who sound like a cross between Guns N' Roses and Gary Glitter will ever quite catch on in the UK. But they're rock, and they're proud. And when I met up with them this week, I started by asking them to explain their musical mission.
To be completely honest and probably boring, we're on a mission from God like the Blues Brothers.
That's quite exciting. I know that's quite normal in the US, but over here, my God, you have God in your life?
Yeah, we do have God. And God came down and he told us to form a band that was going to be dark glam rock that kind of just shakes its wang in people's faces, but beautifully. Maybe there's a little glitter on that wang.
Right.
Because you're not frightened to rock.
Yeah, we kind of live in like post indie times, and then there is kind of like a lack of just like pure passion. Maybe just like ignorant passion. People maybe think about things a little too much, and that's not necessarily what we like about rock and roll.
You like to think about things a little less.
Yeah, I mean, not to say you have to be stupid. It's just like, just go from the gut, and the gut isn't always stupid.
Do you know about Britain and its history with glam rock?
We've heard about it.
You know about Gary Glitter?
Yeah, we do know about Gary Glitter, maybe a little too much.
But we kind of have an ambivalent relationship with it in the way that, you know, we like the kind of the showiness and the dressing up to a certain extent, but we also sometimes put it in the towards the cheesier end of things. Is that how it's perceived in the States?
Kind of, but it's also a little bit of a forbidden fruit. And I guess maybe even in these times, I mean, you go through like all of glam rock from like Little Richard to, you know, T-Rex to Poison. And there's always kind of like an element of outsider of it's not something that everybody wants to get their feet wet in. But that's what makes it exciting to me.
Like any genre, it's good to make it your own. You know, like there's the like, there's Bowie's glam, T-Rex's glam, and then there's like metal glam in the 70s, you know, and we're doing our own brand of it.
Have you heard of a band called The Darkness?
Yes.
What do you think of The Darkness?
I kind of dig The Darkness, but it I think they didn't really last very long because it was kind of a one-trick pony, and maybe they didn't take what they were doing as seriously as their fans did. And not to say that they don't, but it just seems like they didn't believe. It was kind of a little too tongue-in-cheek and not like, you know, we're going to rock out and despite, you know, what other people think of the genre. I mean, you take a look at a band like Turbo Negro, and they have a sense of humor, but they also really, really are into what they're doing, and it makes it interesting.
Tell us a bit more about the album and the themes that are working through that.
Personally, I think Arrogant Army like exemplifies the band the best. It's really, really poppy and just kind of has some classic like Holy Ghost melodies in it. But then we also have like Embrace the Hate. I think that's more representative of where the band kind of has been going. And
right,
it's a bit different than like what most people are doing, I guess, is why maybe it's rearing its ugly head.
Tell us a little bit about this. About the Seattle thing, because growing up you must have been around, or at least, you know, secondarily kind of hearing what was going on in the whole grunge thing. Was that something that influenced you, or did it repel you, or what was your...
Yeah, I think how could you not be like be a kid and see that and be proud that it's from your town? And I think there's always been and still is an energy in Seattle that's kind of like this Neanderthal woodsy kind of like mystic thing that that just comes from Seattle, and I think it's still there now, but it was also definitely a huge influence on us.
I pay my penance chained to the bed, and outside the Spanish children sing. You wear a mask for tragedy, another one for comedy, and neither.
Does the kind of the gigging and the music circuit work differently over here to the way it does in the States?
Yeah.
Why is that?
Coming from Seattle, like, we definitely kind of were like a homegrown thing, booking our own shows, like playing like teen centers and house parties first, and then working your way up to like clubs and like bigger halls and stuff. It kind of has less of a homegrown feel here with everything, even just getting a van. Like, I remember I was like 19 and was able to like buy a van and go on tour. But here it's so expensive. Like, it's impossible for like an 18-year-old to get a van, like get the MOT, get like the insurance. Like, it's like ridiculously expensive. And that's just one aspect of it.
Where would you like to be in 18 months' time? What would you like, ideally, what would you like to be doing?
I'd love to still be a band.
Wow, are there creative tensions already?
No, it's not. No. I think that's always the goal.
Yeah.
And I think if we could achieve that, that's success.
That's Holy Ghost Revival. The single Embrace the Hate is out on August the 18th, and you can catch them at a Vauxhall tavern near you soon. Right, we've got enough time left to whip through a bit of your feedback. Firstly, from Jin, who took issue with my mention of Ipswich in relation to last week's Latitude segment. Ipswich is a town, he writes. Very important thing to remember. Suffolkers are sticklers for accuracy. Yeah, I know that. And that's not the only thing they're sticklers for. And not all of them are legal. As well as factual inaccuracy, however, it appears my habit of mispronunciation is continuing, as Vilius Vodkovicius Facebooked to say, extraordinary pronunciation of my surname. Cheers. I'm actually not sure. Maybe extraordinary means extraordinarily good. What do you reckon, Rosie?
I agree.
Vilius is joined this week by new Facebook friends, including Andrew Norton, James Hopkins, Simon Norris, Kieran O'Hara, Brian Chambers and Birdwolf. You can post comments on this week's show on the blog. Tell us what you made of Holy Ghost Revival and also Mudhoney and DJ Martin Cooling. The address is blogs.guardian.co.uk/music. Rosie, it's been a pleasure to have you.
It's been real.
We're back next Friday. Register now to get the podcast sent straight to your computer or MP3 player for free. You can find out how at guardian.co.uk/music. That's all for this week. We leave you with a bit of live action from the Holy Ghost Revival. This is Next Time I'll Buy. Bye-bye.
All right.
She slipped and skipped to San Francisco. I stayed wearing out my welcome and my jeans. knew she'd come back in the darkest of times, when I had an empty purse and an empty mind. She came back in dark times, I had an empty purse and an empty mind. I said, tonight I've got no money in my life, I swear next time I'll buy. Shut down and scattered across the chateau floor. Well, I've never been this high before, but I know you've got a little bit more. The candles burning behind bedroom doors. Well, it's quiet when the mind goes out. You think this was a civil house. We won't be waking soon. I could be cold by noon. You know, tonight I've got no money in my life. I swear next time I'll buy. Genevieve came crawling through my phone line. Guess the night I left you downtown all alone. Money's gone, I guess she had nowhere to go. She wanted to come and crash out in our home. She tramped up to the door, said the cabbie's gonna be 12 pounds more. Then she said, tonight I've got no money in my life, I swear.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.